You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Gary Apple. I represent the appellant, Sensible Housing Co., Inc. This case gives the court a unique opportunity to clarify what I think are two seemingly inconsistent lines of authority with regard to the procedure that trial courts should employ when deciding quiet title cases. I think that's an interesting legal issue that arises in this case, and I would encourage the court, as I'm sure that you will, to take the opportunity to clarify those conflicting lines of authority, which I will get to in a minute. By the way, I'm sorry, I'd like to reserve whatever time I have left when I finish for rebuttal. In this case, after many years of litigation, there were essentially two issues that remained in the case. One was Ginn's foreclosure claim, and the other was Sensible's claim to quiet title to a portion of the property that was subject to the foreclosure. Ginn claimed a deed of trust on the property. An entity related to Ginn that was called Tigawan Properties claimed it once had title to the property, and Sensible Housing claimed that it owned the properties, and that's how the parties lined up. After the many years of litigation, the parties sat down and stipulated to what issues remained and a procedure for the trial court following resolving those issues. And they presented that stipulation to the trial court. The stipulation, which I think is important, included a provision called, and it extended about five pages, recommended plan for resolving outstanding matters. And it said, I'm paraphrasing and quoting a bit here, the parties have agreed that the clearest and most sensible way to present the issues to the court is for the parties to prepare a new set of briefs. And the reason for that was that the parties had briefed these issues in a variety of different ways, and the arguments were spread over a number of briefs that had been filed 8 years prior to that. The parties, the stipulation goes on to say, therefore, it is proposed that the parties submit consolidated briefs, superseding all their prior briefs, on the following issues. A, whether the plaintiff, and that is now Ginn, and I'll refer to them as Ginn, has standing to oppose PMMC and PLC, and that's now Sensible Housing, motion for partial summary judgment or to request summary judgment with regard to the counter and cross claims asserted by Sensible, and B, whether plaintiff or Ginn or Sensible are entitled to summary judgment with respect to the quiet title counterclaims and cross claims. The parties then continued their stipulation. Again, we'll have 30 days to file its response brief after Sensible's summary judgment brief is filed. With the rebriefing completed, and I'm quoting, the parties suggest that the court decide the issues in the following order. A, first, whether Ginn has standing to oppose Sensible's motion for partial summary judgment and to request summary judgment on those claims. And second, if Ginn has standing, then the court should decide the competing motions for summary judgment with regard to the quiet title claims. That was the stipulation. The parties presented that to the court. There was a brief telephonic hearing. The court then entered an order. The order said, and I quote, the court adopts the stipulation recommendation of the parties dated May 19, 2008 as an order of the court, end quote. The stipulation was that there was a threshold issue, and that threshold issue was Ginn's standing to oppose Sensible's quiet title claims. That was based on applicable law, which we've cited in our briefs in this case, the Bennett case, the Empire case, and the others that we've referred to. Those cases say that if the party opposing some quiet title does not have title in themselves, if they can't show title, then they are out of court, essentially, and they do not have the ability to challenge plaintiff's title. Now, I'll come to what that means here in a minute. After the court entered the order approving the stipulation, the parties then spent months, and it was 6 or 7, I don't remember exactly how long, briefing the issues exactly the way that the stipulation provided. The trial court then decided the issues in an order dated June 3, 2009, and that is the order that is subject to this appeal. In that order, the trial court unfortunately ignored the stipulation that the parties had entered into.
Counsel, doesn't always remain the independent responsibility of the court to decide the applicable law and the legal sufficiency of the evidence?
Absolutely, Judge Roman. There's no question about that. And in this case, the trial court did it, but the trial court did it without prior warning to the parties that they were that the court was going to depart from the stipulation that everyone had agreed to and the court had previously approved.
When we're talking about a stipulation, we're talking about a stipulated recommendation where the parties are suggesting and the parties are proposing and there's recommendations. I mean, you would agree that that's ambiguous at a minimum, wouldn't you?
No, I don't believe it was ambiguous in any regard. I think that what the parties recommended to the court was, one, what the issues were, and two, the manner in which those issues should be tackled by the court after many years of litigation. The court looked at that and said, I agree, I will do it that way. The parties then briefed the issues exactly in the way that they had agreed and the court had directed. The problem was that the court then did not decide the threshold issue that had been agreed to.
What would you have done differently? Let me ask you that.
That's a very good question. We would have, if the court had said, even if the court had said, look, I've approved these rules previously, I've changed my mind. I don't say that the court couldn't do that. Of course, the court reserved the discretion to do that. But the judge should have said, I've changed my mind and we're going to approach this in a different way now. The threshold issue is not Ginn's standing. The threshold issue is now going to be the right of sensible housing, the interest of sensible housing in the property. If the court had done that, we would have submitted a great deal more evidence going to the issue of sensible's title. We didn't do that because of the need to conserve resources. And if the court had told us there was a new set of rules, we would have reallocated those resources, and instead of spending them on dealing with the interest that Ginn had in the property, which we showed, and which showing, by the way, was unrebutted, we would have instead gone and taken the deposition, for example, of the lady who was a party to one of the bills of sale, who was the heir at law of the last director of Pine Martin Mining Company. We didn't do that precisely because of the way that we all stipulated the case would be decided and the threshold issue that was going to be decided. That was what was unfair about the procedure that the trial court followed, was not telling us that the rules had changed.
But shouldn't you have done that anyway, because you were depending on the court ruling in your favor on the issue of Ginn's standing?
Judge Hawthorne, we were. And there is no getting around that. But in cases, you have to make decisions about how you're going to spend your money. We don't have unlimited funds. All litigants don't have unlimited funds. And they make choices about how they proceed. We did that. And as a matter of fact, Ginn did that too. Remember that they did not present any evidence at all opposing the evidence we presented about Ginn's title. There was not a single bit of evidence presented the trial court, and there isn't in this record. You can look in the record for any evidence that they presented to the trial court showing that the deed of trust had not been released, not once but twice, showing that the judgment was not void because it had lapsed under California law, and so on. They didn't do that, so they made the same choice we did, only on the opposite side, obviously.
What was wrong with the trial court doing what it did when it said it would be addressing the threshold issue of Ginn's standing in the process of making its ruling on Sensible's quiet title claim.
I don't see that in the order. As a matter of fact, the trial court said in the order, the only reference to standing in the order, at least that I saw, is at the very end. And ironically, what the trial court rules is that Sensible lacked standing because it didn't have any interest in the property. I don't think, and I, of course, could be wrong, but I don't see anywhere in the order, the June 3rd order, that the trial court addresses the issue of Ginn's standing.
I'm not saying it directly addressed, the trial court did not directly address Ginn's standing, but I thought that the trial court said by making its ruling on Sensible's standing and Sensible's quiet title claim, it was in essence making a ruling on Ginn's standing.
I didn't see that.
Okay. I'll have to look back at that then.
If it did, it was extremely implicit, and it certainly was not express.
Also, because we have very little time, I do want to direct you to an issue that concerns me, and that is the rejection of the purported stock certificate on the grounds that it was incredible by the trial court on summary judgment. Would you agree with the trial that if, well, let me back up. It is one way to read that to say that the trial court is finding that the document was not authentic, that the stock certificate?
I don't know. The trial court doesn't explain it. The trial court says there was no credible evidence, and the trial court does not say there was no evidence. There is a discussion, certainly, by the trial court about that stock certificate, which, as I indicated in our reply brief in response to an argument made by the appellees, the trial court simply misconstrued it. That was part of the problem. If the trial court, if we had had a hearing and the trial court said, I don't understand this document, what is it? We could have explained it at the time. But the trial court just jumped to the conclusion that this document was a particular thing, which it never purported to be. It didn't purport to be a copy of the stock certificate.
Well, in Exhibit 9, it does say that it is a stock certificate, as I read it.
It does, but I suspect Your Honor knows. There are lots of documents that are recorded in the real estate records, particularly older documents like that, that are just retyped versions of the handwritten ones. And that's all this was. And if someone had said, gee, and by the way, this was not an issue that was raised by the other side. So if someone had said, what is this document, we could have easily explained it. Instead, the trial court jumped to a conclusion about what it was, which just was dead wrong.
Reserve time.
Thank you. I'm not going to get to reserve much time because I want to address another issue, and I'll do it very quickly because I think it's an important one. And that's, what is the role of the two lines of authority that the parties have cited, the Empire series of cases, Bennett and Empire on the one hand, and the Hinojos case and its progeny on and predecessors on the other. Let me suggest to you how we can get through this thicket. I think the Bennett and Empire cases say that the defendant in a quiet title case cannot question the right of the plaintiff unless he can show title in himself, and it's only because of that adverse title that he can question plaintiff's title. The Hinojos case says plaintiff bears the burden of establishing a title superior to that of the defendant's and can't rely on the weakness of the defendant's title. I don't think those two rules are in conflict. I think the rule from Bennett is rule of standing. The rule from Hinojos establishes burden of proof. If you read the cases carefully, and I encourage you to reread them if you already read them, each of the cases the parties have cited examines the title of both parties, the plaintiffs and the defendants, on undisputed or stipulated evidence, and it concludes, the court concludes, who has title based on that review. Applying the Bennett and Empire line of cases in this case results in a conclusion that Ginn is out of court because there is no evidence in this record that they have title. So under Bennett, they're gone. On the other hand, that's not the end of the inquiry, and that's where Hinojos and the other cases come in. Under Hinojos and the other cases, just because Ginn cannot question the title of Sensible doesn't mean the court has to grant Sensible relief. Sensible still has the burden of proof, and that's what Hinojo says. And that's how I think you reconcile those two lines of authority. I think, therefore, this case needs to go back to the trial court for the court to, number one, deny the motion for summary judgment that was filed by Ginn for lack of standing, because the evidence is they have no title to the property. But the trial court then needs to have further proceedings to determine, including an evidentiary hearing, because there are substantial factual issues about Sensible's interest in the property. So I would request that the court reverse the decision of the trial court for those reasons. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Michael Martin on behalf of the appellee, Battle Lender, LLC. I am going to address the issues regarding the stipulation and the granting of the summary judgment. Hopefully I can do that in about 10 minutes. And Mr. Joseph, on behalf of Wells Fargo, will be addressing issues regarding standing. First, moving to the stipulation, the party's stipulation specifically provided that they suggested a manner in which the court might decide the issues, or the order in which the court might decide the issues. The use of the term suggests obviously acknowledges that the manner in which the court decides the issues is within its discretion. And Sensible acknowledges that in its brief on page 3, where it admits that the court was not compelled to decide the case as stipulated. Now, Mr. Apple's claim that Sensible was prejudiced in this instance. However, the party's stipulation specifically provided that all the issues would be briefed together. Issues regarding standing, issues regarding Ginn's title or title to the property, issues regarding Sensible's title to the property, all were to be briefed together, and there were multiple briefs submitted by all the parties. Now, nobody knows the manner in which a court is going to decide an issue, and nobody knows what issues a court will find dispositive until you get its ruling. But to the extent that Sensible now claims that it did not offer its best arguments or its best evidence in its briefs, it did so at its own peril, because those issues, those arguments, all should have been made in the same briefs. Also, there's been no showing whatsoever by Sensible as to what evidence it would have submitted that it did not. And finally, as Judge Roman indicated in his questioning, implicit in the, perhaps it was Judge Hawthorne, implicit in the court's decision was a determination that Ginn had standing or had the ability to defend against and to question Sensible's title in the property.
Counsel, I assume you're referring, and I want to ask about that because I think it was my question, and I'm looking at the court's order, and the court says that it is aware of case law stating that a defendant on Sensible's claims, Ginn, cannot challenge a plaintiff's, Sensible's, title without an interest itself. The court finds it most efficient and least confusing to start with Sensible's claims and to address them on their merits, which also decides the standing issue. Now, that's the way I read that the court, by addressing Sensible's claims, was deciding at the same time.
I believe implicit in the court's ruling was a decision on that issue. With respect to the propriety of the grant of summary judgment, summary judgment was appropriate in this case because there was no genuine issue of material fact that Sensible could not establish title to the property, which is an essential element of its quiet title counterclaim. It couldn't establish a chain of title either through Pine Martin or Piney Lumber. And under Colorado law, conveyance of property must be by deed, or perhaps you could do it by the acquisition of a stock of a company that had title in the property. Now, there's no question that the property was never deeded by the original Klein Martin Mining Company to the entity that Mr. Tucker established, Tucker's Klein Martin Mining Company. And there was also no evidence that the original Pine Lumber had anything other than a leasehold interest in the property. Piney Lumber was never an owner of the property and had nothing to deed. And Sensible cannot overcome these fatal deficiencies in its purported chain of title.
But on summary judgment, what are we to do with the trial court making a bunch of determinations that something was incredible?
Your Honor, I think if you look at it, the actual determination there was that there was no evidence. Let's look at perhaps the one piece of evidence that Sensible relies upon in support of their chain of title is the bill of sale, at least on the Pine Martin side, is the bill of sale from the trust, or from Esther Burnett to Mr. Tucker as trustee of November 13, 1995. Now that bill of sale, if you look at its specific terms, it provides that Ms. Burnett is conveying to the trustee, Mr. Tucker, all the right title and interest in and to the following goods and chattels, the corpus of the Pine Martin Mining Company. By use of the term goods and chattels, we're necessarily referring to personal property, not to real property and not to stock. Thus, as a matter of law, the term goods and chattels does not include what Sensible claims that it includes, and what corpus means doesn't really matter because it doesn't mean real property and it doesn't mean stock. And that becomes even clearer if you look at the later bill of sale from Mr. Tucker to the new Pine Martin Mining Company, which specifically states, and I quote, granting all the right title and interest in and to the following goods, property, stock, and chattels. When the parties wanted or intended to transfer stock and real property, they would include those terms. That wasn't included in the original bill of sale. And thus, I think the court can determine as a matter of law and interpret it, whatever the term corpus meant, it didn't include real property and it didn't include stock.
Zach, I'm having trouble how the court, as having to take every inference in favor of the non-moving party, could say, well, I don't believe corpus has any meaning.
Yeah, corpus was not a definite term, but I don't think we need to get there, Judge Rothenberg.
Okay.
And the reason I don't think we need to get there is because we know that corpus was goods and chattels. It falls within that subset, right?
Well, I don't know. That's your position.
Well, it says that the following goods and chattels, the corpus. So we know it has to be a good and chattel, or good or chattel, in order to give effect to all the terms of the agreement. So I don't think we need to get there in terms of what corpus meant or what it didn't mean, because for purposes of the issues that are involved in this case, it didn't mean real property, it didn't mean stock, it didn't mean ownership. And there's also other problems with the complete lack of evidence. There was no evidence that the corpus was ever transferred, whatever that term meant, from Pine Martin to Bouvier. There was no evidence that Bouvier, who was one of six original shareholders and directors of the original Pine Martin, was the sole surviving shareholder. And there was no evidence that Bouvier had any authority to transfer the corpus of Pine Martin to Esther Burnett. Regarding some of the other issues in this case, the trial court did not ignore evidence of payment of taxes It just determined that you couldn't use that to establish title. This isn't...
Well, I understand you have a Georgia case, but there are a number of other cases throughout the country, especially in adverse possession areas, that say that the payment of taxes by one purporting to be the owner is a factor that can be looked at. It's not in itself sufficient to show ownership, but it is a factor. And it seemed to me the trial court refused to consider the payment of taxes. Am I wrong?
Well, I believe the trial court did consider the payment of taxes. It just ruled that if you don't have any evidence of title, the payment of taxes is not probative of that. It doesn't get you there. Now, I understand that the payment of taxes in adverse possession cases, certainly it's probative of possession. But in cases like this, quiet title actions, you have to have some type of evidence of title. You know, and if it was a question of the interpretation of something that was ambiguous in a title document, then, yeah, sure, the value or the evidence would be probative. But that isn't the issue here, because there was a missing fatal link in the chain of title, and there was no evidence of title.
Well, on page 30, I'm looking at the Wells Fargo brief. It says the Pine Martin track was owned at one time by original Pine Martin, and that seems to be undisputed. And it seems also undisputed that Sensible, or its predecessors, was paying taxes on the owner, on what it claims to own. So the next question is, did Sensible link it up? In other words, looking at every inference in Sensible's favor, is there enough to link up the original Pine Martin with the current ownership?
And I think that harks back to what I was talking about earlier, Your Honor, and the fatal deficiency, the fatal absence of a link in that chain of title, is you cannot show a transfer of title, ownership, anything from the original Pine Martin to Tucker's, what I refer to as Tucker's Pine Martin or Sensible, because of the problems with the bill of sale. I will turn it over to Mr. Joseph. Hopefully I didn't take too much of my time.
May it please the court, my name is Seymour Joseph, registration number 11330, representing Appalachia Wells Fargo. Very briefly, several points I'd like to make. First of all, I think the standing issue is really a red herring in this case. The key point in this case is cross motions for summary judgment were filed. Cross motions for summary judgment about Sensible's title. Sensible asserted that it had title. It had every incentive to present whatever evidence it had in support of its title. It was its motion for summary judgment. Ginn filed a cross motion for summary judgment. Sensible had no title. If there was any evidence out there that Sensible had title, it had an obligation to present that evidence. Contrary to Mr. Apple's opinion, I don't believe there's any conflict in Colorado law at all. As decided by the Supreme Court earlier in this case at 70 P 3rd 1176, which we call Battle Mountain 2, every defendant has standing. If you're going to assert a quiet title claim or a conversion claim or a fraud claim against the defendant, defendant always has standing to answer and defend that claim. All the cases that Mr. Apple relies on, Webermeyer, Bennett, Monroe v. Ash, Empire Ranch, they all involve a judgment that one party did not have title. That's what Colorado law is.
Without getting into standing too deeply, Mr. Joseph, I'd like to follow up on what Judge Roman asked, and that is, the trial court seemed to insert itself in a way that we rarely see. A charade, it made all kinds of comments in its ruling, and it used the word credibility several times. Now, we're looking at summary judgment. As he mentioned, the standard of review is that the trial court simply cannot make credibility determinations. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I would point to the Anderson versus Lindenbaum case. The Anderson versus Linden.
Which reversed the granting of a summary judgment. I know there's language from Justice Coates that says the court can occasionally, if there's nothing. But following up what my colleague asked, why is there nothing here? That's what I'd like to hear from
sure.
you.
I think there's two issues. One, which Mr. Martin touched on, is that there is no evidence. There is no evidence. There's two titles at stake here. There's the Piney Lumber Tract and there's Pine Martin Tract. The Piney Lumber Tract title depends on a lease option. There is no evidence in the record of the existence of this lease option except a document, a self-serving affidavit from Mr. Tucker. The court struck that affidavit in one of its rulings, and that ruling has not been challenged by
the court. It's part of one affidavit and the entire other affidavit.
Was also struck. Mr. Apple is incorrect in his reply brief. He said it was not, but actually it was struck by the court in an order that was entered in June of 2009. And that's
so you're saying there's no Tucker affidavit left in this case?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
All right, because that's a factual dispute between you and your opponent.
That's correct. And I would say, Your Honor, that the language in Anderson versus Lindenbaum about evidence must be credible enough so that a reasonable jury will believe it to be true is good Colorado law. After all, Rule 56 does say that to defeat summary judgment, you must present evidence of facts to present a genuine issue of material fact. It's not any issue of fact to throw up against the wall.
Going back to the facts, so you were talking about Piney Lumber and the other, the lease option, no evidence of the lease option.
Correct.
And as to the other Piney?
There is absolutely no evidence that Mr. Charles Bouvier was ever a shareholder, let alone that he owned the majority of shares. I will disagree with Mr. Martin. If you look at Exhibit 7, which is the 1915 Articles of Incorporation of Pine Martin Company, Mr. Bouvier is one of six directors. The Articles of Incorporation says there's 2,500,000 shares of stock, but does not identify any of the shareholders. There's not one bit of evidence that Mr. Bouvier was a shareholder, let alone a majority shareholder. Now, Mr. Tucker got the Errett Law, and there's no evidence of how Ms. Burnett is the Errett Law, to sign this corpus thing. Corpus means nothing if Ms. Burnett has no authority or ownership of original Pine Martin. I can sign a corpus. That's not evidence that I have any authority to do anything for Pine Martin.
Why aren't we bound by the, excuse me, by the inference, if Mrs. Burnett claims she's the heir or heiress, why aren't we bound by giving a favorable inference?
Well, first of all, even if she is the heir at law, there's still no evidence that from Ms. Burnett or anyone else that she had authority to do anything with Pine Martin. If there's no evidence that Mr. Bouvier had stock, even if she's an heir at law, there's no evidence that she would have inherited that stock, let alone inherit a corporation, which no one can do. There's no evidence that she's an officer or a director of the corporation. Even if a dissolved corporation that's been dissolved for 55 years still has ownership of the property, you still need someone who's authorized to act on behalf of the corporation to deal with assets of that corporation.
Thank you, Mr. Joseph.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And
if I may say, we appellees ask that judgment be affirmed.
Yes. And Mr. Apple, since we went over the time limit for the appellees, the court will provide you with 2 minutes to respond to those last questions that were addressed. We were over by a couple of minutes, I think. So I think, in all fairness, we need to let Mr. Apple respond to those last couple of questions posed by Judge Rothenberg.
Well, thank you very much, Ron, and I appreciate the 2 minutes. The issue, I think, Judge Rothenberg, that you were raising related to the what the trial court did in resolving the summary judgment. I agree that there was a substantial bending over by the trial court to ignore inferences that the trial court should have raised. I think that the applicable Colorado case law on summary judgment dictated that what the trial court should have done was concluded, for example, that because Esther Burnett asserted that she was the heir at law, the court should have concluded that, number one, her father had died, and number two, that she had the authority to move forward and grant the bill of sale. The issue of what the corpus was clearly a factual question. It couldn't have been anything else. And I'm extremely troubled, as I believe the court should be, by the fact that the trial court undertook its own factual analysis of what corpus was in a summary judgment context. And I think that was clearly wrong. What the court should have done, I believe, is to say, we don't know what corpus means. It's something that depends on the intent of the parties. It isn't an abstract legal concept. These documents were prepared by laymen, and the court needs to get to, in order to get to the truth, the court needs to understand what corpus meant, what their intent was. And I think you could only do that at a hearing where evidence is presented, not in the summary judgment context, as was done in this case. Thank you.
Counsel, and thank you, counsel, also for your arguments. This matter will be submitted, and an opinion will be issued in due course. Thank you.